Welcome to Franciscan University of Steubenville's Distance Education Program, a series of lectures bringing the classroom to you. For the next several weeks, this radio station, in cooperation with Franciscan University of Steubenville, will present a course on the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church. Your professor, Father Giles Dimmock, a Dominican priest, has 29 years of teaching experience and is currently chairman of the theology department at Franciscan University of Steubenville. For more information on Franciscan University of Steubenville's distance education program, call 1-800-446-8336. Or, from outside of the United States, call 614-283-6517. And now, here's Father Giles Dimmock with this week's lecture on the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church.
Now, we're pretty much finishing up the sacrament of marriage. Basically, what are the effects of the sacrament of marriage? Well, the bond of the sacrament of marriage is considered permanent and exclusive. And that's really important because it gives the couple strength in crisis, strength for their duties. If you've got a kind of commitment in which you think that when everything goes wrong, then you can just sort of get out of the commitment, then basically, you know, what kind of stability is there? And so the teaching of the Church is that this bond, when it is covenanted by two people who are free, who are baptized, and it is consummated, that is, sexually completed, then such a bond can never be dissolved. Okay. So, as we will see, that means that the Catholic Church is opposed to divorce because the Lord Jesus brought the sacrament of marriage back to the original unity of the two. This is basically a commitment for life. Okay, so that consequently, it may be sometimes that there are different ways of looking at the marriage commitment to ask whether or not the people were really free, whether they entered into it, were there various impediments which might have kept it from being a valid sacramental bond. But once it is established that that is the case, it can simply never be broken. And we'll talk about that some more. Thirdly, there's a special gift, sacramental grace, that comes through this sacrament, strengthens their unity, helps them to grow in holiness, helps them to bring up their children well. In the Catechism, Tertullian describes Christian marriage. How can I ever express the happiness of a marriage joined by the Church? This is 1642. Strengthened by an offering. What does that mean, strengthened by an offering? Strengthened by the offering of the Mass, okay? Tertullian's one of the first ones that witnesses to the fact that marriage was celebrated at the Eucharist sometimes in the early Church. We're not sure that was always the case. Strengthened by an offering, sealed by a blessing, announced by the angels, ratified by the Father. How wonderful the bond between two believers, now one in hope, one in desire, one in discipline, one in the same service. They are both children of one Father and servants of the same Master, undivided in spirit and flesh, truly one in flesh. Where the flesh is one, one also is the Spirit. Okay, so Tertullian is singing the praises of Christian marriage, the sacrament of Christian marriage. Okay. Now, what are the goods, the so-called goods of marriage? Sometimes you see them referred to as the bona, the goods, enunciated especially by St. Augustine, and the requirements. Well, first of all, when we're talking about conjugal love, we're not just talking about sex affecting the body. We're talking about the body. We're talking about the emotions. the instincts, the affectivity. We're talking about the spirit. We're talking about the heart. We're talking about the mind. Marriage affects the totality of the person, the totality of the man, the totality of the woman. It's this personal unity, not just a sexual unity, but a personal unity of the two, communion in heart and mind. Sometimes you run into couples who are married, but they no longer communicate. And they just kind of sort of like live in the same house. And it's very sad to see that, because this union of spirit, of mind and heart, of spirituality, the two shall be one flesh, means not simply have sexual intercourse, but it means a unity of life. And when you see, for example, a couple who no longer share anything, that's really very sad. For a marriage to really flourish and grow, it really demands this indissolubility. Okay, the bond cannot be broken. That's what indissolubility means. My novice master always used to make us put the accent on the dis. I don't know how you say that. That's very difficult. Indissolubility or something. But anyway, most people say indissolubility. He used to make us say St. Jerome instead of St. Jerome as well. He was very odd. Anyway, now, indissolubility requires, that is, that this bond is at least for the duration of this life. In a sense, it is actually for eternity, although we've talked about the fact that in heaven they neither marry nor are they given in marriage, so that there's a sense in which one goes beyond union as we know it in terms of heaven. So that basically what we're talking about is something that the stability of marriage really requires this. Of the two, of the couple, the Catechism emphasizes that each person has equal dignity, so that polygamy violates this, like marrying one wife, and then another wife, and then another wife, and then another wife, so that consequently one has, let's say, I think the Muslims are allowed four wives, you see. Or there was a custom not widespread, but in some tribes, polyandry, whereby one wife is kind of like the queen bee and has several husbands. Either of those violates the uniqueness, the dignity of the man, the uniqueness, the dignity of the woman, okay, who are meant to give themselves in love, not just as one of a series, but as unique, and to have that received and appreciated as a unique contribution, and the other person responding and being loved uniquely. You know, like when people fall in love and carve their names on trees and do things like that, they hope this this love, they sing the fact that this love will last forever. That's the human desire. Where does that desire come from? Is it not part, maybe it's a bit romantic, but is it not part of God's plan? That basically that's the way human beings are. You know, I really will love you with all my heart as number three wife somehow doesn't quite cut it. Yeah. That means that I'll love you until number four comes along. Well, you know, okay. Okay, so indissolubility is one of the goods of marriage. Secondly, fidelity. Fidelity is being faithful. Because the Catechism points out, and actually I just said it another way, love longs to be definitive. You don't want to love someone who's going to say, well, I'll love you till somebody better comes along, you know. Even in terms of a friendship, you want the friend to be a good friend for life. Some of you are going to make or have made friendships here that will last you for the rest of your lives. Okay, and that's what we want in friendship. That's what we desire, basically. And, of course, St. Thomas says marriage is the highest form of friendship. Yeah. Okay. Now, the mutual self-giving demands fidelity. How can the wife give herself to her husband whom she knows is cheating on her? How can the wife or the husband give himself to his wife who knows that she's cheating on him? It's very difficult because in a way, this language of the body that the Pope talks about, this mutual self-giving, in fact becomes a lie. You know, I love you and only you and you are my beloved. Not true. Somebody else is over here waiting in the wings as soon as this little action is over. Okay. And actually, the good of children really demands this atmosphere of love and fidelity. Recent research on the children of divorce often shows the insecurity. And certainly one of the reasons why a lot of young people are not always in a position to make a commitment in terms of marriage is because they've experienced divorce. They've grown up experiencing their parents splitting. And it's not the kids' fault, although it is interesting to note that research has suggested a lot of times when this happens, kids somehow think that in some strange way, some sort of strange logic, which isn't true, that somehow they're at fault. Secondly, a lot of times it makes young people rather frightened of this commitment. Well, it didn't work for my parents. How can I be sure it's going to work for me? And so there are many problems. So just sociologically, we can talk about the importance of the stability of marriage. And, of course, this fidelity is a mirror of God's love for Israel in the Old Testament and, of course, Jesus' love for the church, which will be forever. Now, you might say to me, and it's certainly true, that there may be situations where living together becomes impossible. The man batters his wife. He does not respect her. He physically harms her. For the woman to stay in that situation, there's danger to life and limb and to her and to the children. There may be a situation where it simply becomes impossible for the husband, for example, to stay with the wife. There are times, therefore, when the church permits physical separation. And it may permit civil divorce to bring about the legal effects, you know, so that, for example, it can be determined who will take care of the children so that there is child support. But that is never, ever considered by the church permission to remarry. In Matthew 10, the Lord makes it very clear that Moses permitted divorce for the hardness of the hearts. But I say unto you, it was not so in the beginning. So the Lord brings marriage back to that original unity, that unity of the two. Now that's somewhat different from an annulment. Sometimes people have legal divorces and the church gives an annulment. What is an annulment? An annulment is saying that there was something very wrong in the marriage right from the beginning. Something that was so serious that it would stand in the way of it being a valid sacramental bond. For example, the couple or one of them did not intend indissolubility at all. They were just thinking, well, hey, I'm in for this for the ride. As long as the music plays, as long as it's sweet, I'm with you, babe. But then after that, hey, I gotta hop on my motorcycle and ride off into the sunset. You know? Well, if that's the attitude, then they're not intending marriage in the Christian sense. Or one of them may not be. Or what if they're intending open marriage right from the beginning? Namely, meaning we'll live together, I understand you have your needs and you understand I have my needs. Maybe just to be tied down to one another might be a bit much. So if I come home and find you bedding down somebody else, I won't be upset and you won't be upset if I do the same. well, there's an intention that goes so contrary to the Christian understanding of fidelity that whoever had such an understanding, even if the marriage were took place in the Sistine Chapel, even if it were celebrated by the Pope, there would be such a deep defect in it that it would not be considered a valid marriage. It could be dissolved. Perhaps somewhat more common these days, we're not going to have any children. We don't intend to have children. We thought we'd raise poodles instead. Children cost too much money. We're in really into our careers. We think of this more as a merger than as a marriage. BMWs are costly, and townhouses, and so that consequently children are really most inconvenient. Besides, the world's overpopulated. We all know that from Beijing. And so that consequently, how could we possibly bring children into this cruel and dreadful world? So we'll just surround ourselves with luxuries and just smother ourselves, you see. Well, that is such a parody of Christian marriage that if the couple, who actually would be very selfish, we've already pointed out that the beauty of woman is she corrects the selfishness in man, and the beauty of man is he corrects the selfishness in woman, and the beauty of children is that they correct the selfishness in both of them. Okay, so if someone or a couple or either parties should not intend to have children, that would be such a profound defect that it would get in the way of the the marriage itself, its validity. Are there others? Yes. Supposing one were a homosexual or a lesbian and really found it extremely difficult to have sexual relations with the opposite sex. Supposing the man were impotent, could not have natural sexual intercourse, or the woman were frigid. Supposing, for example, that one or both were so immature as to really lack what's called discretion. In other words, they hadn't really a clue as to what marriage was. They were kind of going into this as a kind of lark or something like that. A maturity, psychological maturity, is not always the same as the age, you see, the physical age. So there may be other things that could be so grave as to stand in the way of Christian marriage. Two baptized who are free to make this decision, who enter into marriage planning to be indissolubly united to the other person of the opposite sex for the purposes of expressing their love for one another and having that union crowned by children. A little postscript is in order, perhaps, just occurred to me. You will hear it said, and there was a lot of publicity about this about a year ago, that a scholar from Yale supposedly had discovered ancient manuscript that showed that the Catholic Church had blessed homosexual marriages. And there was a great deal of publicity and touting of this. However, reading more carefully, one found several things that were of great interest. First of all, this custom was not a custom of the Western Church. It tended to be more a custom of the Eastern Church. Secondly, what seemed to be being blessed was a close spiritual friendships, sort of covenants of brotherhood, and I forget there was a technical name for it, but in none of it was there the slightest hint that this had anything to do with a sexual relationship. Okay, that actually the author, the researcher, was filtering it, it would seem, through his own gay orientation, and was in some way making something that was quite innocent and rather beautiful, I suppose akin to what you see in the movies sometime, Indians being made blood brothers or something like that, in a Christian way. You can have extremely close female friends if you're a woman, extremely close male friends if you're a man, and that's a great gift and has nothing to do with sex. And so that consequently, when you hear references to like to something like that, that's really quite erroneous. Never was it known. Or perchance, if something like that ever happened, there were any kind of blessing, then that of course would have been some sort of very strange perversion, very strange something highly irregular, but no way approved by the church. But what this person was doing was reading into something that was really quite innocent and something quite on another plane, which he clearly could not understand. Okay. Now, it is important to note, however, and Pope John Paul II had made this very clear in his encyclical on Christian marriage. He pointed, did I say Christian marriage? I meant Christian family. What is the name of that? I forget. Familiaris Consortium, indeed. So that consequently, in Familiaris Consortium, there were some who theologians were saying, and alas, three German bishops recently proposed, the so-called conscience solution. What does that mean? Okay, I got married, let's use me, okay, I'm a young man, I'm not a priest, for example, so I get married. I marry Sally, and she seems to be a lovely woman, and we settle down to marital bliss, to have children. Well, it turns out that that Sally's pretty unstable, and I find out that she's not interested in being a mother. She's now out every night at the local pub, flirting with various men. She's often found in compromising positions. And it seems to me that we keep talking about it, we've gone to marriage counselors, that this is a really bad influence on the children. And so I speak to the pastor, and so I just can't live in this situation anymore. And so he says, well, I understand. And so that consequently, I file for divorce, and the custody of the children are given to me. Now, here I am, a divorced Catholic man practicing. I've got three kids, and I'm still in the life of the church, in the heart of the church, and I receive Holy Communion. And, well, it turns out that Heather sings in the choir. Heather is just the most wonderful young woman. She's always wanted to have children. Anyway, I ask her sometimes to babysit. The kids think she's just wonderful. And so that consequently, it seems to me I really ought to be able to marry because my marriage with Sally, I mean, Sally was such a floozy, and Heather would make a perfect mother. And how can I cope with all of this by myself and hold down a job? Wasn't daycare so expensive? And besides, I love Heather. I've come to see her as a fine, upstanding young woman. And certainly God would understand and would not hold this against me. Now, what some theologians proposed, and the German bishops raised the question, because we know a lot of people in situations like this who therefore remarry. And so that the constant solution was saying this: even though I can't prove it, I know that in my case, according to my conscience, the first marriage was invalid. The first marriage was not a real marriage, and consequently, I should be able to marry again. And if the church cannot marry me, nonetheless, I know that I am free to be married. And therefore, some theologians said, and it seemed that some German bishops were proposing, that pastors kind of reconcile these people and say, well, I understand your situation, and so that consequently I invite you to receive Holy Communion. You're doing the best you can. Pope John Paul II made it very clear, and the Catechism repeats that I am not free to marry Heather, even though I think I have grounds, since I cannot prove it, and that consequently, if I do marry Heather, that I am not in full communion with the Church. Both Familiaris Consortio and the Catechism makes a point that the church should be very merciful to these people, should try to help them out. Sometimes they do a lot of good things. They raise their children well. They're very faithful about going to Mass. They are members of the church, but they are not in full membership. They are not in good standing. Consequently, they may not receive Holy Communion. There are some situations where occasionally older people who are in situations like this, for whom sex has become less important to them, it happened to some relatives of mine, where the priest was able to simply say, well, are you able to live as brother and sister? Are you able to live and not have sexual intercourse? And my uncle and his second wife said yes. And so the priest was able to hear my uncle's confession and regularly bring him communion. He was very old and very ill. Okay? But the problem is, you see, that in the eyes of the church, my uncle was still married to his first wife, even though she had married someone else. Okay? The church doesn't feel that it has the power to change the teaching of Christ. The church does not have the power to change the teaching of Christ on the ordination of women. The church does not have the power to change the teaching of Christ on marriage. The church does not have the power to change the teaching of the Old and the New Testament, for example, on something like homosexuality. There are many things that are beyond the power of the church. The church has certain limited power, but it must always be in accordance with the faith as given in the scriptures and as understood in living ongoing tradition. Okay.
What about if such a conscience, like the example that you just gave, occurred, could that person enter a holy order?
Normally, you mean like, for example, become a religious or become a priest? Normally, before a divorced person is able to pursue, people have done that, but before they're usually able to pursue religious life, church law today requires an annulment, that the marriage has been declared to be a non-marriage. There was a very famous case. It's an interesting book if you come across it. It's called The Strange Case of Cornelia Connolly. Pierce and Cornelia Connolly, in the last century, were wealthy Episcopalians in New York. They were more and more drawn to the Catholic Church. He was an Episcopalian minister, and she was his wife. He was more and more drawn to the Catholic Church. He convinced his wife to kind of separate from him so that he could study for the priesthood. And first of all, she was not wild about becoming Catholic, but he wanted to, and she studied it, and she sort of began to understand, and so she was drawn to it, and so that consequently they both became Catholic. He talked her into a separation so that he could study for the priesthood, and she went along with it, and that pretty much meant that she had to become a nun. And so that consequently, she studied under a religious order, and she founded a new congregation, the Congregation of the Holy Child. They're big in Philadelphia, I think. And basically, she just sort of more and more took to this religious life. Meanwhile, he's becoming very dissatisfied with the Roman Church, even after he's a priest, and he leaves it and goes back to being an Episcopalian. And by then I think they were in England. Maybe she was in England and he was in the States. I'm not sure. But anyway, in an English court, he sued for the resumption of marital rights for sex in a British court. Meanwhile, she, sort of following his lead, has taken a solemn vow of chastity, because in some ways he kind of pushed her into it. Interestingly enough, the British court held with her, that she had embarked upon a new mode of life and that it would be against her conscience and she could not do that, and therefore he never won his case, which is interesting. So anyway, I believe now the church insists on an annulment of such a marriage so that there could never be any such claims. Yeah. Yes.
Just like the example that you just gave of those people getting divorced and so forth, wouldn't they be, well, I don't understand why there couldn't be an annulment, but they could still be separated. Like, wouldn't it have to be one or the other, or if they're separated, they have to be one?
Well, as far as I can tell, the church used to allow a husband and a wife, if they both, and may still even, if they both mutually agreed to it, if both of them felt called to the religious life, which is a higher state. I'm a Dominican. If I felt called to become a monk, then the church would allow me to leave the Dominican order and to become a Trappist, because that's considered a higher state, to be a purely contemplative. So, as rich and beautiful as marriage is, if both freely, now there's the catch, if both freely felt called to embrace religious life, you know, St. Paul says that a husband and wife at times should abstain from sex for to devote themselves more to prayer. That text has been sort of understood as kind of giving permission, should they be called to a higher state, to be able to pursue that. I knew the case of a Jewish convert and his wife. He wanted to study to be a priest, but she never felt called to be a nun, and he kept trying to talk her into it, and she didn't want to. So anyway, he never got to be a priest. Yeah. Okay. Now finally, the Catechism makes it very clear, as indeed the Second Vatican Council makes it very clear in Gaudium et Spes number 48, that the institution of marriage and conjugal love are by their very nature directed to the begetting and the upbringing of children. Sometimes simply, that's one translation, sometimes simply called the procreation and education of children, and crowned by it. This does not rule out the other ends of marriage, that is, the mutual support, conjugal love. They are not of less account. However, the Catechism says the practice of conjugal love disposes spouses to cooperate generously with the love of the Creator. So that the very institution of marriage is for the mutual love, and it is crowned by the having of children. It is so sad today that children are seen as a burden. The woman who was the Secretary General of the conference in Beijing said that a mother must be crazy. No mother would want 8 children. A mother must be crazy to want 8 children. What a negative way of thinking. Not every woman could have 8 children, but there are doubtless there are wonderful mothers who are able to have 8 children and who rejoice in having 8 children. Those 8 kids are glad to be here, and they're glad to be alive, and they're glad to have her as their mother. There's a lovely old Italian proverb, each bambino comes bringing a loaf of bread under its arm, which means that it is true that it is the church is very much opposed to contraceptives. The church is very much opposed to pills, diaphragms, condoms, jellies. I'm sure there are other clever devices of which I know not, that stand in the way of the mutual self-giving of the man and the woman, whereby they are saying to one another, I love you, but not your fruitfulness. I love you, but not your seed. Now, it is one thing to deliberately frustrate God's plan. It is another thing to use the rhythms of the body and what we know of the body for a good reason, so that the natural rhythm of fertility of the couple, and particularly of the woman, may be utilized. Is it possible that having another child just now would be very difficult because there are already three little ones at home, and that it's difficult for the mother to care for them? Is it possible that the family income is stretched to the limit for necessities? I'm not talking about saving for a Harvard education. I'm not talking about the extra BMW. I'm just talking about getting by with a Chevy and making the mortgage payments, and so that we're not out on the street. Okay. So that there are There are considerations, health, finance, psychological health, unemployment, which mean that a Catholic couple in good conscience can use natural family planning. Natural family planning is often derided as Vatican roulette, derided as being ineffective. Actually, when people really understand it, it tends to be extremely effective, especially with the taking of the woman's taking of her temperature and the knowledge of the mucus secretion. Then this tends to be quite reliable. The couple, however, needs to have a generous spirit. They need to be open to life. Pope Paul VI, in Humanae Vitae, scored the contraceptive mentality. You know, we are going to have two perfect children, along with our house, which is completely paid for, and our cars and our jobs. We will have the boy and the girl, and then we have done our duty, and that's it. Well, hopefully one of the kids won't die in crib death. Hopefully one of the perfect couple will not be killed in an automobile accident after a prom or something like that. The selfishness of parents is fostered in selfish little monsters. There was a thing on television about kids and the toys they want and how Americans are spoiling their children by giving them all sorts of gadgets and toys. And I was just sort of chuckling to myself, thinking, well, nobody sees that these are some of the consequences of not having larger families. The most Catholic countries of Europe, France, and Italy particularly, will not be Catholic much longer. The Muslims are there reproducing themselves in ways that are wondrous to behold, and the Catholics are having their 1.5 kids, not enough to reproduce themselves. We as a nation will probably do fairly well because of the immigrants who come, not because of the native population, but the immigrants who come who tend still to love children and want to have children. The Hispanics are also very helpful in this regard in terms of probably keeping the Catholic Church going, maybe even giving it some faith, you know. And it's interesting to note so much of this pro-abortion, pro-contraception tends to be aimed at the third world, at lesser types, who are not quite as lily white as we, some of us Anglos, are. There's a very heavy kind of racist orientation in a great deal of this. And it's all geared towards the first world so that we can enjoy more and more of the benefits of full production. The Vatican's answer has always been not necessarily that people have to have extraordinarily huge families, but rather that if it is necessary to plan families, that it be done unselfishly, that people use means that are more conducive to the dignity of the couple. Many contraceptives are aimed at the woman, many of them. That the woman is the one who needs to make herself the constant free sexual playmate who is sterile, while the man is scot-free to do whatever he wants. Natural family planning includes the husband and the wife together working at this. And at times, both of them have to sacrifice the love in terms of physical lovemaking, but they also learn other ways of expressing their love. They also learn how to communicate more. It's interesting to note that couples who practice natural family planning, there's a very, very low divorce rate. Interesting. They're communicating on many different levels. They're sharing on levels that go beyond the physical lovemaking, as beautiful and as rich as that is. So, Consequently, the teaching of the Church, as the Catechism says, the fruitfulness of married love extends to the moral and spiritual and supernatural life the parents hand on. Their fruitfulness is not simply having as many kids as absolutely possible. Their fruitfulness is being as generous as they can be in their circumstances, having the number of children that God sends them. They may need to plan that. They are never free. And one of the problems with the contraceptive mentality is that if it doesn't quite work out the way we want it to, then abortion's kind of the backup. Okay? So that even at times, if a child is unplanned and nonetheless is sent by God, then the generous couple welcomes that child with love and frequently are surprised. Often, the surprised child ends up being the child that sometimes is the most loved and the greatest joy. But this fruitfulness is also not just the number of children, but also the whole atmosphere of the home, the domestic church, the atmosphere of the handing on of spiritual and supernatural life, helping the young children to grow into good morality, not just the morality of law, but the understanding of the virtues, the understanding of why morality, so that the people are open to the life of God within them. And therefore, in this context, the Church insists, and continues to insist, that parents are the primary educators of their children. Therefore, if they wish to homeschool, they may. If they have some say about the schools that their children attend, they have every right to. The American Educational Association is not, or Federation of Teachers or whatever it is not necessarily the prime authority. Pariti may not always be that expert. And that's true even in Catholic schools, and that's true even in terms of catechists. The Catechism concludes by pointing out that the family, as the domestic church, is especially the exercise of the royal priesthood. Christ grew up in a family. He loves families. The church is God's families. And family life is so important today, where people grow up insecure, where sometimes people are uncontrollably violent. So much of that can be traced to the breakdown of the stability that a good Christian family, a good Catholic family, offers. Okay, well, we have finished the sacrament of marriage, and the last two classes will have to do with the sacraments of holy orders. Okay?
This has been Franciscan University of Steubenville's Distance Education Program, a series of lectures bringing the classroom to you. Join us again next week for another lecture on the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church with your professor, Father Giles Dimmock. For more information on Franciscan University of Steubenville's Distance Education Program, call 1-800-446-8336. Or from outside of the United States, call 614-283-6517.